You are listening to Radio Albion.
Greetings from Appalachia, the northern part of Appalachia. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is the Orthodox Nationalist podcast series. This is going out on the 20th of March, I think, 2024, and so that's right after the new calendar, St. Patrick's Day. And back when I was at the Voice of Reason, I did a lot on Ireland, being an Irishman myself. I taught classes on Ireland, especially Mount St. Mary's Frederick. And it's been a while since I've covered it. E. Michael Jones's book on Baron Metal dedicates about four or five chapters to the potato famine, the great hunger, as it's called. And this is what we're going to be dealing with today. More specifically, the economic antecedents and causes of this absolutely inhuman set of events. It isn't so much, it was a matter of not direct murder, but a hostile neglect. You got to remember, we're talking about the British Empire at a very degenerate time in its history. They were British rather than English. And at the time, you know, the famine was from 1845 to 1852, they were under the thumb of the Rothschild dynasty. And the reason for that is mass landlord indebtedness, not just in Ireland, but in Britain. A tiny percentage of the population in Ireland controlled most of the arable land. But this landed aristocracy spent their money not so much on investment economically, but on luxuries and frivolities, monument building, this sort of thing. It wasn't real productive investment. There was a boom in lending starting in 1780. And the boom and bust cycle finally broke by 1845 and beyond, in the panic of 1848, leading itself to the revolution. So by 1927, a full third of all powerful families in Ireland had lost their lands entirely. These families are the result of the Reformation, specifically the invasion of Cromwell and what can only be considered a deliberate policy of genocide. The Reformation permitted the stealing of monastic and parish lands all over Europe, and Ireland was no exception. The theft of lands created a sense of private property and the very first real estate market. But it isn't as if they'll be satisfied with acres that they have stolen, but they always borrow against it. It's never enough. And that creates a bubble, as we all know. But it also, once the loans came due, once the interest rate went too high, you had the enclosures and you had increasing exploitation of workers. There was a whole lot of reason behind this. You know, they had, you know, mortgages were streamlined. Insurance companies came up, rates were fairly low. There was some professionalism in the economy now, and some of this created the debt. So by the time the famine hit, the elite in Ireland, connected with Britain, was so saddled with debt, there wasn't much that they can do. About 100 years earlier, there was another famine that was handled very differently. We had to get to why these were handled differently, 100 years apart, here in this talk. Another reason was that, you know, after the victory of Napoleon, so much of Europe's product went to, especially Germany, the German principalities went to Britain, given the nature of the blockade. But what this all amounts to is an alien ruling class in Ireland who viewed their tenants, remember these are absentee landlords, so they also have middlemen that take a percentage. You also had local usurers, usually at the tavern, or hated by the local population. And this was constant. It's whatever was monetized in Ireland at the time was deeply indebted. And one of the causes for this destruction is the gold standard. Now, I've gone back and forth on that question for a long time, but I think E. Michael Jones has convinced me that it's a bad thing. But in order to even catch up with their interest payments, let alone the principal, the point was that the Irish tenants were absolutely worked to the limit. So that's the basic foundation. And it's one of the things that makes the Great Famine to be handled much differently than the famine 100 years earlier. So the fall of 1845. The blight is a fungus-like body. It's a rapidly reproducing, thousands of spores, and it spreads rapidly. Given the economics of Ireland, population growth, smaller pieces of land to work, less land available for the average tenant family. Potatoes were a cost-effective alternative to grains. What, you know, at the time in Britain was generally called corn. Corn refers to all cereal grains. But the blight had been around for a little while. Remember, 100 years earlier, it was frost that caused it. This blight destroyed much of the crop. It had been seen in America in 1842, and it was reported in a few other places. And at the time, the head of government in England was Sir Robert Peel, soon to be replaced by John Russell. And those, not only in his cabinet, but really the ruling class in general in London was anti-Irish. Remember, the land war was going on. You know, the Irish tenant who has seen his rent increase massively in the last 50 years or more, and then being overworked, absolutely underpaid, was always going to the local usurer. Because these were, you know, anti-Irish, due to the land war, you know, the British landlord in Ireland can remove his tenants at will. They could rack rent, and rack rent means that you can increase the rent yearly, taking into consideration any improvements made either by the lord or the tenants on the property. And of course, that does not, those improvements do not remain with the tenant. So the land war was against this kind of thing, sporadic violence, but in general, you had the Ribbon Men, the Molly Maguires even got to America. In summary, at this point, the Irish tenant, that is to say the Gael, the Roman Catholic Gael, was reduced to almost something along the lines of highly malnourished slaves. And the religious differences was always, from Cromwell on down, was used as an excuse. British lords in Ireland, the Anglo-Irish, didn't have any fellow feeling with the Gaels, who were many of their tenants, most of their tenants. We all know, I mean, I can't get into the Jacobite material, but the Highland Scots, as well as the Gaelic Irish, sided with the Stuarts, leading to their eventual near annihilation afterwards. So religious differences, I mean, the very fact that you have an absentee landlord class, given the nature of the land war, British landlords didn't live, maybe visited once in a while, their domains in Ireland. So they would simply collect and hire a middleman to do a lot of the hands-on work at the time. You know, the family, like say, Lord Palmerston, his family, explicitly, by his own admission, became wealthy because of the Reformation era land expropriation. In fact, his family comes directly from Cromwell in the 1640s. And that's what created this alien Protestant landowning class in Britain. Well, the penal laws were enacted in 1695, and that was after the rebellion, the Jacobite movement, was defeated. The penal laws, you know, you couldn't enforce them everywhere, but Roman Catholic Irish Gaels could not hold any office, could not vote, couldn't really own property, couldn't have a bank account or anything like that. Clergy could be killed at will. They simply were non-people. Now, it was repealed later on, but that was the foundation of the relations between the two peoples. Now, as far as the Irish, Anglo-Irish lords are concerned, Palmerston being one of them, their indebtedness is what brought them to the point where they didn't think they had any choice but to work their tenants to the bone. And given the nature of their debt, there's not much they can do beyond that. They were constantly selling off plots and therefore kicking the tenants off on a regular basis, both before, during, and after the famine, making matters worse. Around the turn of the 19th century, the Act of Union between Britain and Ireland created a regime of total free trade. You know, essentially it was now one body under the London government, and that destroyed local Irish businesses. Small manufacturers were all absorbed into the highly industrialized British juggernaut at the time. So the Act of Union was one of the last straws that created a tenant class that did not own property. So in other words, they were agricultural proletarians. A proletarian, by definition, is someone who doesn't own the means of production. It is owned by someone else, and they can only work on it. So all of these factors, everything from population growth to rack renting to the nature of the financial system at the time, the Act of Union created an impossible situation for the Gaels. And on top of all that, population growth had increased thanks to the potato. And a lot of that came from the very anti-Napoleon blockade anyway. That was, you know, the working Irishman's meal was founded on potatoes rather than bread. The average tenant, if they were lucky, were self-sufficient in food. So they really didn't have a monetized economy. They weren't part of the market. They weren't part of the economy at all. But the big difference between the famine 100 years earlier, 1740 versus now the famine of 1845 and on, is ideology. And that ideology is the free market, free trade, which was accepted by both Tories and Whigs in the middle of the 19th century, where we are right now. And that, in fact, usury, lending at interest. This is all part of the economic contest. Darwin was just starting. His literary work and competition and one the stronger destroying the weaker was becoming a day-to-day part of basic political discourse, in especially in London. In fact, many of these guys, and I know there's one very infamous, Nassau Sr., this actual its name, Nassau Sr. was a professor at Oxford, and he welcomed the famine. It was a way that the population could be controlled. The land war can be finally won, and the Irish really are getting what they deserve. So the laissez-faire ideology had a lot of help with some basic anti-Irish, especially during the land war, prejudices from the British side. And the real bad guy here is the Undersecretary of the Treasury, and that was Edward Trevelyan. He, as anti-Irish as Peel or Russell, was placed in charge of relief. Typical, you know, Scottish Enlightenment, Adam Smith, David Hume kind of mentality. Anything that smacked of charity that didn't come from private enterprise was illegitimate. It restrained trade. It rewarded laziness, all these nonsensical excuses so as not to have to do anything. That's the big difference. The other big difference, of course, between the two famines is the sheer amount of indebtedness. That there really was not only no help for the Irish tenant, but no help for the landlord either. And the Rothschilds were buying this stuff up all over, not just in Ireland, but in Britain too. Lord John Russell, Peel's successor, said the same thing as Trevelyan did. And the slogan was, no disturbance in the orderly course of trade. Now, there's another factor, and that's the Corn Laws. When I first started in this field, other than abortion, the Corn Laws, believe it or not, was the first historical political issue that I tackled via Russell Kirk. Corn Laws were enacted in 1815, repealed in 1846, so right in the middle of the famine. And the Corn Law was a import tax on all corn or cereal grain, all cereal grains. This was a big Tory talking point. So many of the lords were of the Tory party. And the point was to keep corn prices high and hence profitable. You did have strong forces for repeal, and that would lower the price of food and stimulate demand. And it had to be done in 1846, but almost the entire Tory party voted against repeal. It took a little while, maybe a little less than a year, for Peel to realize how severe the situation had become. Even still, the Tory party rejected. And this is why, you know, Peel, despite his party affiliation, sought the repeal of the Corn Law. And an early solution was to buy corn maize from the U.S. That is to say, the American Indian, you know, what we call maize. Unfortunately, that wasn't particularly, and also, you know, grain from other parts of the empire, but it had no British market because it was hard, it wasn't nutritious, it was hard to prepare, hard to eat. The Irish really couldn't eat it. It would tear your stomach, because it always had sharp edges. It was terrible. You know, only desperation could lead you to eat this stuff. But they bought 100,000 pounds, which is, you know, a drop in the bucket. So by the fall of 1846, now we're at a year, the death rate is growing by leaps and bounds. But even, you know, regular workers are not being paid at this point. Starvation wage is the average wage at the time. This is what I mean by saying the tenants were squeezed. Labor was squeezed for every drop of value, given the massive levels of indebtedness. the elite had in Ireland. British came up with the workhouse idea. Actually, that had been around for a while. And there, of course, that was not a living wage either. And one of the worst parts, from the Poor Acts in Britain, was that even if you owned a quarter of an acre of land as an Irishman, you were not eligible for any kind of relief. Because these workhouses ended up being quite crowded, typhus broke out. And as many died from disease, especially dysentery and typhus, as from starvation. Of course, starvation made people more vulnerable. Now, the way that the poor laws operated in Ireland, relief was raised through local lords. There was a rate attached to them, and that's where the money came from for these workhouses, etc. So what ended up happening, they didn't have the money for this. So wages were so low, you needed children working, women working, and the man in order to earn enough. And even that was very iffy. Charles Wood, who was a new Chancellor of the Exchequer, he came up with the public works idea. Using the tenants to do infrastructure-style labor. And that way, the liberty of trade would not be harmed. That was repeated over and over again. And again, just like everything else, the pay never reached even close to subsistence level. And you had a few instances where you had local lords taking out another loan, specifically for this, at a rate of 4%, to pay for. Now, it isn't so much that, like in 100 years earlier, the lords were quite willing to assist. This isn't a personal issue. Now they simply couldn't, through their own, irrationality. They couldn't assist. And many of them were incapable of paying the interest of what they had at the moment. The winter of 1846, January of 1847, were going monthly. 300 a week just in Cork alone. Exposure, starvation. And any attempt to steal any kind of corn was harshly punished. If there's ever a time, you're talking about almost an entire nationwide psychosis brought on by starvation and disease. These weren't people anymore. Now, the Quakers did a very good job in organizing relief efforts, and it's their firsthand account. We realize how bad this starvation psychosis went. People became absolutely zombified. But one of the punishments for stealing any kind of cereal grain was transportation. And that means you're sent essentially to be a slave, in this case, the penal colony of the Bahamas. But Trevelyan revealed his true colors. Infamously, he stated that this level of starvation, and this is a quote, proves that God never meant for the Irish to be a great people. He went on to say that it's a judgment of God, and they're being punished by God for their rebellion against Britain over the previous decades. And this is a man who was put in charge of relief efforts. Another big difference, though, because of this ideology, 100 years earlier, that famine saw all exports shut down. That did not happen 100 years later, and again, because of the free trade ideology. But even though the corn laws were repealed, prices remained very high. Allowing food imports, which was a big issue at the time, the fear was that it would cut into the profits of grain speculators, or really grain dealers. They wouldn't have the incentive then to buy up food if the price continued to fall. In other words, that was far more important than actually feeding a now increasingly psychotic population. So the concern with a lack of state interference, though, did not stretch to the sending of the British Army into Ireland, because lots of food was being exported. Starving Irishmen had to see these ships with heavy escort go buy laden with food abroad. Imports were shut down. Not exports, but imports. 1846, the crop was far worse than 1845 because they were eating the seed potatoes. Free trade was the mantra, and that's what the troops were there to enforce, and that was far more important than anything else. The corn that was created, that was grown, was shipped abroad, truly to pay basic interest. About 3,000 troops were sent. Initially, they were all very well fed. Prices continued to climb despite the corn law repeal. Speculation made it far worse. Trevelyan even said that price gouging, which was very common, both by middlemen and you know, their spokesmen, Trevelyan even said that that's part of the free market. Price gouging is not an immoral practice. Now, we've been talking on this show about what the Enlightenment was. When everything is reduced to random materialist motion, cause and effect, that morality is really just a matter of sentiment rather than any kind of natural law. This is what you're going to get. Ideology is far more important than actual people. So there was no restraint on price gouging. But why wasn't the 250 ships in Cork Harbor with 80,000 tons of food, why wasn't it unloaded? It was guarded by the army. It's because prices had gotten too high. There was no market for it. And the idea of subsidizing this was an outrage to the British government because there was no demand. Well, the demand simply was because no one could afford it. And as this is going on, the British press is being extremely irresponsible. Even Russell, new prime minister, called the Irish lazy. This is of their own making. And you had a small minority of lords that were doing very well. Now, the theory was that higher prices will attract import from America, and that should stabilize the price. But that didn't show up, really, until the spring of 1847. European governments were buying a lot of these potatoes being shipped out of Ireland because it didn't just affect the Irish, but because that ideology on the continent wasn't as powerful as it was in Britain. You had far better programs that the governments created to feed the population. And this is where the healthy potatoes that were grown in Ireland went, because that's where the best price could be found. The Quakers talk about mass death. They talk about psychosis. They talk about cannibalism. The British did respond. This is not an anti-English thing. It's an anti-capitalist thing, anti-usury thing, because you had many charitable societies growing up in Britain raising money for this. This was international news. Massive death from disease and starvation, and of course, immigration. Tsar Alexander in Russia sent thousands of pounds worth. The Ottoman Empire, so many elite families, including the Rothschilds, sent money, but not from necessarily from the state. I mentioned the Irish poor laws from, actually, they were created in 1838, but that had to be paid by landlords. So both having Trevelyan as your point man for aid, under this circumstance, with those poor laws, there was very little chance. However, the British sent 20 million pounds for the emancipation of black slaves in the Caribbean. The clothing and supplies that they needed to start over again now as free men were explicitly rejected for the same treatment sent to Ireland. It would bypass Ireland and go to the Caribbean. And that will show you exactly what race of people was more important to London. So by this point, it doesn't matter. You know, you could have all the money in the world. No one could work. Tens of thousands were dying of disease brought on by hunger. Massive typhus academic That was a very harsh winter. So by March of 1847, huge typhus and dysentery outbreak from very weakened bodies and a trauma that affected everyone, especially children. You didn't have a single mentally healthy person on the island at the time. 1847, though, the British media clearly blamed the Irish for this. Finally, the soup kitchen idea was set up in Ireland. There were very few of them. And one of the reasons that you had this massive outbreak of dysentery was because this soup was tainted. Not deliberately, but it had zero nutrients in it. It was essentially garbage that attracted the various microbes that caused disease. Actually, the British press was saying that starvation is a hoax. This is just a way for Irish nationalists to raise money that they can buy weapons with. You know, they're talking about the land war and the rest of it. The Economist, as we all know, one of the worst, most damaging publications, was founded around this time. And they condemned all charity. It's like the old libertarian condemnations of welfare. It rewards laziness. It creates dependency. And all of this was just, they didn't, you know, whether they believed it or not is irrelevant. Because no matter what, they were not going to spend money. The very fact that they were spending money on the black slaves in the Caribbean, refusing to do the same for Ireland, is extremely telling. In 1847, the London Times said that the famine, which was real, finally they had to admit it, was a good thing. It allows a demographic responsibility, given the nature of population growth amongst the Gaels over the preceding 100 years. Later on, the Irish lords, Anglo-Irish landlords, were blamed. Remember, they were the only ones who could vote. They were 3% of the population. About half the land in the entire island was owned by a couple of hundred powerful families, tracing their roots back to Cromwell. Either that, or they went to the hands of the Rothschilds, who was able to, you know, when their loan was called in, they were able to take their assets. Landlords were selling land and hence kicking off tenants constantly. But the lords were blamed for their miserliness, despite it not really being their fault. They had nothing. They couldn't pay the interest on their debt. The point is, given the poor laws of 1838, if you're a landlord, you have many starving tenants on your watch, kicking them out, or maybe even sending them to America, is really your only option. And that was condemned later, not in 1847. Evictions were extremely common. 1847, there were 500,000, at least official evictions. But you also had, quote, voluntary agreements, which brought that up to 1,000,000. And not necessarily all of them were recorded. But even the ships of the immigration, it was just as bad on the ships, the coffin ships, as it was in Ireland proper. Canada was the big destination. And when they got there, they were already diseased. So they were just left. They were left to wander around at least as much as quarantine allowed them. So removing tenants by one way or another was the only way they could stay solvent. And of course, 1847, you had a major economic crash. The price of gold fell. So that automatically means that paper money had to be curtailed. They didn't have anything to lend. I mean, gold was needed to buy food abroad. That automatically means rates go up. That means rents go up. Now, let me talk about the gold standard. I promised that in the beginning. The gold standard, I used to like it because it created a level of restraint. It was a stable unit of value. And that's exactly what it does. Once the crops failed, though, the gold standard itself would prohibit any further loans. Gold fixes value. Therefore, any expansion in productivity is not met with any more money. It becomes intensely deflationary, and hence interest rates go up. Over time, your purchases are far higher. You're getting less for more work because, again, in order to pay this off, tenants were worked to the bone. But because of the charity eventually permitted from Britain, the Rothschild family was up in arms. And this is straight out of E. Michael Jones's book. It was Lionel Rothschild at the time. He had his brother, Nathan. He ran for office as a Whig and, of course, bought his seat. He thought that Ireland could ruin, destroy capitalism and usury, since it was such an obvious example of market failure. Jews realized that they had to take the state directly when the corn laws were repealed and charity was permitted. That automatically means less spending. By this point, there is no money for labor whatsoever. Let me give you an example. George Bingham was one of these lords. His estates, he had about 60,000 acres, and he had mass evictions. He said, "I will not breed paupers to pay priests." The Earl of Portingham had about $700,000 worth of debt, and it only brought in maybe pounds. It only brought in 30,000 pounds a year. Lord Ranmer had about 5,000 income every year, 200,000 pounds of debt. So, and those are representative figures. The broader point, of course, is that usury, and hence the gold standard, led to tenants being treated as slaves. Again, potatoes come from the initial blockade against Napoleon because it was something that was cheap, easy to do, and of course monoculture became the norm and total dependency. Again, this is all part of the free market ideology. So population growth led to further and further subdivisions of land. So even without the blight, you would have had substantial problems, both from lords and tenants. Having even a small amount of land, let's say, for example, 1.5 acres, if you plant potatoes, you have enough to feed a family of six for a year. Now, other cereal grains, corn, you need 10 acres for the same amount. So the potatoes seem to be a very rational solution to the problem. And it wasn't so much Adam Smith taking over the mentality, it was Malthus. The idea that population growth leads to a quote-unquote correction, in other words, mass death. I mean, in 1847, even the hospitals were completely exhausted. Anything that was sent was a drop in the bucket. The problem is that the famine didn't fit the capitalist model. I've been saying for 2 decades now that the growth of capitalism and industry in Britain was mirrored in Ireland. The dark side of capitalism was to be found in Ireland, and it didn't fit the norm. Trevelyan always said that the Irish are exaggerating. They're prone to exaggerate. And so much of this comes from the work of Cormac O'Grada and a great book by Cecil Woodham Smith. So even if you got a job, we talked about the poor laws and the workhouses. Workhouses were supposed to be, and public works, were supposed to be the solution. Well, of course, that assumes that you can work. They were earning 8 pence a day, and the only thing they could buy was this Indian corn, which they couldn't eat. The lords had to borrow to pay for relief. And all this Indian corn comes over, that's also a product of speculation. But let me get into more detail here. The gold standard and the famine. In Britain, the Bank Charter Act of 1844 lowered the ratio of gold to paper money. And of course, this is always a fixed amount. That's the claim for the gold standard. Anytime you have a growth of interest rates, loans are called in. You know, as I said in the beginning, these bubbles are created by low rates. Then when borrowers can't even pay the interest, then you have, well, the panic of 1847. The railway boom, which the Rothschilds financed, not just in Britain, but Austria-Hungary, etc., that was over. Paper increased only when gold and silver increases. There was some assistance from the California gold rush, which was occurring at the same time, but only on the margins. So paper is issued really for speculation, but when gold reserves shrink, which is what happens when you run a trade deficit, paper goes away too. The Bank Charter Act of 1844 also had a reserve requirement. Every bank had to have a certain amount of gold. And it was foreign speculation that led to deficits and hence the flight of gold from the Bank of England. So the drain on gold limited the amount of paper that anyone could issue. No loans were possible, and that was in part due to the law of 1844 and the reserve requirements. So what was the altruism, if you want to call it that, of Peel, condemned by the Rothschild family? And this is what brought Lionel, not his brother, although his brother was very suspicious of this whole thing, to run for office as a parliamentarian. In 1847, the panic hit. Russell ended any food program in Ireland. Food shortages lead to a trade deficit. Trade deficit leads to the drain on gold. There was a minor famine in Russia, 1891-1892. The Tsar spent not only a massive amount of his own personal money, but maybe 2% of the entire GDP for relief. And it was, you know, localized. Figure the total rent income amongst lords, maybe 13 million pounds worth. What went to loans, principal and interest, was about 10 million. So all they had as a collective was about 3 million pounds at their disposal. And even that was shrinking. So that's the connection between the gold standard and the famine. So you have the nature of this dependency. You have massive debt. You have a huge amount of prejudice and contempt for the Irish. You have political battling. You have population growth. You have the free market ideology. All of this conspired to make the potato famine one of the worst in all history, even though technically the famine 100 years earlier, proportionally, I should say, had a greater death rate. So anytime Britain would run a trade deficit, gold has to be sent to pay. Less gold, fewer banknotes, given the fixed ratio and the reserve requirements. That means credit is intensely restricted and rates rise. Lots of gold means low rates, but low rates is only rational for a short period of time because they always overborrow. That just happened in the U.S. just a few years ago. Then that leads itself to unrepayable debt once the bankers realize that these people don't have the ability to repay. And of course, this is predatory. This is absolutely predatory. So in a boom economy, you had low interest. Any price decrease, you can't pay the interest anymore, because your product isn't being sold for what it used to. Banks recall loans, bankruptcy is the result, and money is withdrawn from circulation. And in Britain, you had the boom and bust roughly every 10 years. The gold standard, in other words, is inherently deflationary. And the one group of people who lose, wherever they are, is labor, in this case, the tenant farmer. Now, other than the authors I mentioned, E. Michael Jones does have an analysis here that I think is a very good one. You see variations of this elsewhere. But the basic concept is that moral depravity comes into existence because of the ideology of the Enlightenment. That is what leads to this reckless and irrational spending. And of course, what leads to very high debt, which automatically leads to the control of the Jewish banking elite. The Jews, either directly or indirectly through middlemen, own most of the land, at least at home in the empire. So these indebted lords and tenant farmers actually had a reason to work together. The Rothschilds always profited from expansion, whether it be the opium trade, the Burmese ruby mines, taking the debts of Egypt and Sudan. And the Navy was there to collect. Jones brings up the Don Pacifico affair. A man who lived in Greece, although a British citizen, the Greek debt was held by the Rothschild family. Because they're Jews, the Greek government was very worried about this, and so they banned the practice of burning Judas in effigy every Easter, or just before Easter, simply for fear of the Jews. Now, the population, on hearing this, rioted. They went to Pacifico's house, who was the wealthiest Jew in the area, and caused a certain amount of damage, amounting to like 8,000 pounds. Palmerston, foreign secretary, sends a note of outrage to Greece and threatens that the Navy will be used to collect this judgment. Not the Greek courts, but the British mandated. He threatened to use the Navy for this one man who had his house ransacked by angry Orthodox people. To be a citizen was the same to be a merchant. The Navy did arrive, in fact, January of 1850. If his claim isn't paid, we will start seizing Greek ships. Russia and France vehemently condemned this reckless use of the Navy. But if that story doesn't tell you who's in charge, then nothing will. It's a proof that the British state was under the control of the Rothschild family. The Gold Standard had very strong support in the Masonic lodges. So, 1840s, 1850s, the Rothschilds take over more and more slowly, but surely. Landed indebtedness is what led to this. But deflation is something else I want to mention. It doesn't come up much. Inflation comes up, but not deflation. 19th century, both the population and the level of productivity increased. But money is held constant, thanks to the gold standard. So any increase in production, with the same money in circulation, would cause a fall in the price of what's being produced. Scarce money automatically equals high rates. And the example used very commonly, let's say in 1868, you take a loan of $1,000 to buy a farm. 20 years later, given the nature of deflation, you have to grow 100% more. You have to double your production to repay this loan. And you could never really keep up with it. So the dollars to pay this debt, given deflation, has twice the purchasing power as it had, for example, 20 years earlier. In America, it was the Fourth Coinage Act, which brought the U.S. after the Civil War to back to the gold standard again. So deflation leads to lower prices for farm goods, America, England, anywhere. And falling prices is really the same thing as usury. The farmer had to produce more, but that ends up being self-defeating. So you have to borrow at high rates and paid back with less valuable money due to the nature of the low prices. In other words, metals have no relationship to actual social needs, other than leading to the revolutions of 1848, the panic of 1847, the human cost of the Great Hunger was extraordinary. The population decline from 1841 to 1851 is substantial. In all of Ireland, you're talking about a full fifth or 20%. But it differed. In Connacht, it was maybe 30% of the population disappeared. In Ulster, it was about half that. Munster, maybe 23%. In Leinster, almost 16%. You had a population of roughly 9 million in 1841. The census of 1851, the population comes out to 6.5 million. Now, without the famine, population growth would have brought that in 1851 to 10 million without the famine. So what would have been a million increase in population led to it was a substantial decrease in the population. It was a guy named Joel Milker went county by county in Ireland and came up with the estimate of 1 to 1.5 million. Irishmen gone, death, early grave, transportation, or emigration. The big difference from 1740 famine, based on frost, and the 1847 famine, was ideology. But it's that very same ideology of so-called moral sentiments rather than any conception of natural law that led to the wild spending in the first place. You had tremendous debauchery amongst the lords, Anglo-Irish lords in Ireland, living, of course, in the cities in Britain. Their estates in Ireland were simply cash cows that they could occasionally use. They realized that's going to run out. The aristocracy who owned these lands was getting worse and worse over time. In other words, this is a total perfect storm of variables and events. Now, there's always the big claim that this was deliberate genocide. It was not. But it was very clear that the British ruling class of either party didn't mind the concept, because the land war is now, it was resurrected a generation later. But no one can work, no one could rebel. The one country that wasn't able to take advantage of the revolutions of 1848 was Ireland, despite it all starting there. Ireland became a rallying cry, and it's unfortunate. The Communist Manifesto was published in 1848. Engels was very interested in the situation in both in Britain and Ireland for the working and tenant classes. But not only did this lead to a strong questioning of capitalism, especially on the continent, it also led to the wonder about who these Rothschilds are and why is it that the Jews are permitted to buy up everything because people can't pay their debts. Even an aristocracy that doesn't have a whole lot of economic education, doesn't even know how much money he has, is spending recklessly. Where did this whole mentality come from? And what causes this? To the point where economic ideology is far more important than starving children. You could ask that question, the American support of Zionism, which is slaughtering babies on the Gaza Strip, deliberately hitting hospitals, caravans of all kinds. Whoever in the Gaza hasn't been killed has severe post-traumatic stress. Especially these kids are never going to be normal, no matter what happens. But the interests of Zionism is far more significant to the ruling class than the lives of Arabs. And it's the same here. Ideology was far more important. What tends to happen, though, whether it be in America today or in Britain yesterday, the public, after a while, gets tired of this. 1848, 1849, the British public didn't want to hear it anymore. And the stories of mass death weren't even making the newspapers like they used to. They were suppressing the realization that their government was involved in this through neglect, if not through positive policy. And that has to come out somewhere. The Americans, too. This gets repressed. No one wants to deal with the fact that you have babies being killed, toddlers being killed, knowingly, by the IDF, and that the U.S. says that that's perfectly okay and condemns anybody that will fight against it. How that comes out is a different story. And one of the ways, as I've been talking for a long time, is in projection. When you repress something, you're using and utilizing a defense mechanism. What direction that goes, everything from denial to transference to projection, is the result. It's tough for a population to accept what they are and what they support and the government that they consider theirs. Therefore, it's very easy to construct an enemy and to project all of that unwanted baggage. And the Irish were a place that could be projected. Irish revolutionary. Today, it's Vladimir Putin. People who don't know the first thing about international economics or the situation in Ukraine are flying these stupid Ukrainian flags, usually the wrong variant, without the tribes of St. Vladimir in it. But as I've said 100 times on this show, it's no accident that every problem that the U.S. is mired in is projected onto Russia, onto Belarus, onto Iran. And their predictions never come true because they're not dealing with analysis. They're dealing with a neurotic defense mechanism. It's also plausible to say that the millions and millions of pounds sent to free the black slaves of the Caribbean were a way of relieving themselves of the guilt of deliberately not deliberately starving Ireland, but deliberately diverting aid. By the panic 1847, all assistance was stopped, and the only people you had, of course, the Pope of Rome sent a fortune. How much of it actually got there is another matter. Buying food from abroad, but no matter how much money was sent, I think ultimately 10 million pounds from 1845 to 1852 was spent by the British, which when you break it down is an unfortunate drop in the bucket. It was misused. Buying the Indian corn was really nonsensical. But all of the arguments that libertarians and normie conservatives make today about welfare or anything else were used at the time to justify starvation. Never underestimate how much the alienated Westerner can sublimate, can repress, and more importantly, never underestimate their powers of justification and rationalization. Even if there were no blight, you wouldn't have, 1.5 million people gone in one way or another. But you would have had chronic malnutrition, which was pretty much the state of affairs throughout the rest of the 19th century, and certainly was a state of affairs. I mean, you had rickets was a huge problem. Rickets and scurvy. One, vitamin C deficiency, the other one, vitamin A and D deficiency. Caused by this utter monoculture. Communists, unfortunately, took advantage of this, presenting themselves as the alternative to capitalism. And as you know from listening to me, that is only at the height of superficiality. Nothing changes in the Enlightenment materialist point of view. Human beings are human resources, really, and nothing else. The very fact that the limited charity, and now when I say the 10 million pounds, that's not government expenditure. It may include government expenditure, but that also includes all the charitable societies that the English put together. Quakers being weirdos were really the heroes of all of this. And state assistance ended, as I mentioned, from Lord Russell in 1847. The possession of gold is not the same thing as prosperity. The possession of gold has nothing to do with the just rewards of labor. Gold was useless during the potato famine, although as a mechanism of deflation, given the massive levels of debt, it's a totally different story. The debt wasn't nearly what it was in 1845 as it was in 1740. There was far more room to maneuver. The fact that they were still charging 4% interest when a lord would borrow to pay his rate for poor relief on his estate shows the nature of this ideology. And what little was done from the state apparatus was too much for Rothschild. And he decides to run for office with the understanding that this is going to come to an end. The Irish are the way they are. They deserve to be punished. Charity just means dependency. It's probably a scam. They're using all this to buy weapons, to kill Englishmen for no reason. This was the argument. It's a very poor rationalization, but it was a big part of the argument. Other famines, I mean, there was a famine in 1740, and this one, the Great Famine. They were specifically nasty. Now, in 1740, it was quickly reduced, as well as the other famine that occurred in Ireland in the 1870s. But in 1845, it took on the proportions that it did for all of these reasons. The nature of free market ideology, population growth, subdividing of land, the total alienation between lords and tenants, increase in food prices, the ideology that says anything in restraint of trade is a huge problem. Ideology taking on almost a talismanic mentality in both parties in Britain. Increasing deflation, the exodus of gold from the Bank of England, the mentality of the Rothschilds, and of course the massive debt. In the midst of the land war, which already poisoned many British minds from the Irish issue, all of this was the perfect storm of death and destruction for Ireland. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.